Hey everyone, this is Ben Morton and welcome back to episode number 13 of the podcast. This episode is a recording of my interview on the Professor Greg Wells podcast that came to fruition as a result of the two of us spending a cold January morning walking around London together, having a brilliant conversation. In this episode, Greg asked me all about my take on servant leadership, some of my experiences leading soldiers on operations in Iraq during my time in the army, and what it's like to operate under extreme pressure. We also dig into the power and need for leaders to really understand our personal values and seek to align them with the organization that we belong to or the organization where we operate as a leader. We also dig into journaling, checklists, and all sorts of other practical and tactical things that I do and have picked up over the years. I hope you find it really interesting. So without any further delay, here is my interview with Greg Wells on the Greg Wells podcast.
Ben, thanks for joining us, buddy.
It's a pleasure, absolute pleasure to be on the podcast, Greg.
All right, so where am I finding you today?
A little market town about 35 miles north, directly north of London in the UK.
Very cool. So we're speaking across the pond. That's fantastic. And I had a chance to hang out with you recently, which was just an incredible day when I was in London, and we had a good chance to catch up. So perhaps you could just give everyone an idea about, you know, what you do and, you know, what your day-to-day looks like these days.
Yeah, I guess so. Fundamentally, I'm a leadership guy, always have been. That's always been my passion since, I don't know, I was 12, 13, really. I've always loved building, creating, helping others build like really awesome high-performing teams. So that's kind of what I've always done. Started off 10 years in the British Army, kind of a stint kind of working for some fairly big corporates in the UK, still in the sort of leadership HR space, and now getting on for sort of 7 years coaching, consulting, working with senior kind of exec teams, that sort of thing in the UK and around the world.
Very cool. Tell me about the start in leadership when you were 12. Like, that's it's pretty early that you figured out, you know, well, maybe not even figured out, but you instinctively went in a certain direction and got started. Give me the backstory.
It's a good story. So bless her. If my mom were in the room with me right now, she would probably tell you that I decided to join the army about 5 or 6 years old. Okay. I'm not quite sure it was that early. But there was like an open day at a local sports complex, and kind of the army recruiting team were there. And apparently, as the story goes, I walked past and was just mesmerized by the kit and equipment and the soldiers. So mum says she knew at that point that's Uh-oh. It. She'd lost her son to the army. I think the conscious decision was probably when I was about 13, sort of through the army cadet force in the UK, where I finally made the decision. But even as a boy at school, I always loved kind of captain in the rugby team and trying to make our school rugby team be as good as it possibly could. So I don't know where the thread came from. I don't have a history in the family of service in the armed forces, but it was just something that was in me and has been the constant through life and work, I guess.
Very cool. So if you were to sort of look back and say, you know, nature versus nurture, this is a good, maybe a little bit of both, but what was it that captivated you about the army and leadership? And, you know, give me a bit more of an understanding about, you know, what your mindset might have been and just, you know, how you entered into this stream for your life.
Yeah, so we could spend the next 50 minutes talking about the nurture nature debate. I don't think it's either or. I think it's both. But I think my personal journey, and again, I'm not entirely sure where this came from, maybe a little bit from the values of my parents growing up that was kind of naturally instilled in me. But I've always, service has always been important to me, sort of a sense of duty and service, being of service and in service of others. And maybe that's why I sort of thrived and was successful in a military leadership career, because that's very much what they train officers in the British Army, that you serve in the army to lead. So it's very much about others first, more about what you give up as a leader rather than what you gain from your position. So that's always been there for me. I, looking back, as you do, trying to join the dots, probably a large element of that came from my parents, especially my mum. I mean, I was kind of similar to lots of kids growing up, that kind of, I saw my kind of parents fall out and go through a divorce. One of the choices they made, which now as a parent I would never make myself, but I totally respect why they did it, was they stayed together for the sake of me and my sister.
Right.
They said, we'll divorce and separate once kind of the kids are grown up and old enough and they've left home. And mum in particular sacrificed a lot to do that, a lot of her, I guess, her own happiness to make, in her mind, to make me and my sister happy by being in a stable home. Like, so it's that sort of sacrifice piece, that value kind of, I very much saw as a child growing up. And I suspect that kind of shaped my values and my leadership philosophy, I guess.
Very cool. And I'm really interested in the idea of servant leadership, which you've mentioned a couple times, and being of service as a leader, I think is an important idea that I've seen more and more and more come up recently. And that, you know, for even CEO level people, you are serving the people who work for you, not the other way around, which is counterintuitive. It's actually the opposite of what most people probably think of as leadership. So can you dig into that a little bit, just since it came up? And I'm just fascinated by that idea.
Yeah, so I think where it started for me again was, so the motto of the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, which is where the British Army trains its officers, inscribed on the cap badge wearing your beret, it says serve to lead, which actually has a very clever dual meaning. On the one hand, as a officer in the army, you serve in the armed forces in order to be a leader. Your primary job is to be a leader, which is an interesting distinction in the corporate world, because we start doing our job to do some form of doing, and then because we're good at that doing, we get promoted to being a leader. But very, very few of us, in my experience, set out on our career in the business, corporate world, civilian world, wanting to be a leader. It tends to be a byproduct of, this is how we increase our earning capability.
Right.
Whereas in the military, the start point for me was never about doing any doing. It was about being a leader. So there's that first aspect, you serve to lead. And then the second meaning of the motto is, in order to lead, you must first serve.
That's so super interesting.
So as a leader, it's about what you give up in order to lead people, earn their trust and respect. It's about putting your needs second and putting the needs of those that you lead above and beyond your own.
So then I'm going to sort of try to get you to go to a place where, that we discussed last time we were hanging out, where you clearly put the needs of your team ahead of your own and took a leadership role in an incredibly difficult situation in Iraq. And the moment when you looked into the eyes of your, I'll let you explain it, but I think you know which moment that we're talking about. I think that would be maybe a good example of you sort of putting your words into action.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's
and if you don't want to talk about any of this stuff, by the way, just be like, well, see, I'm not going there, and that's totally fine. But like, we can go in a different direction if you need to.
If you see me start twitching, you know, then you know to move on.
All right, sounds good.
So the story you're talking about was in Iraq, or Iraq, as some listeners might say. So it's back in 2003, so in the second Gulf War conflict. And it was probably several weeks into the conflict. And at that point, pretty much the entire Iraqi Army Republican Guard had sort of ditched their uniform, started wearing civilian clothes, disappeared into the civilian population. And that was really the start of the guerrilla warfare or counterinsurgency campaign that then kind of escalated into the stuff we saw with kind of roadside bombs, mortar attacks, all of that sort of stuff. But what that meant for us was suddenly our world was turned upside down from fighting a very traditional type of war or campaign where kind of we were one side wearing kind of green or yellow, the enemy in front of us wearing a different colour uniform, to patrolling the streets of the southern city of Umkazar, not knowing who was friend, who was foe, who was trying to help us and give us genuine intelligence, who was watching our every move as we left our compound, ultimately trying to kill us. So what that meant was we started conducting a series early on of sort of nighttime house raids in the city to capture suspected Republican Guard kind of officers and key personnel. There's one particular kind of night I was giving my set of orders for the operation, and it was one where we knew it was going to be pretty volatile. We weren't sure what we was going to be faced with as soon as we crashed into the particular target house. We knew a crowd would very rapidly form around us and turn hostile. And I kind of prepared my set of orders for the soldiers. I'd kind of rehearsed it over and over again. I knew what the plan was. And as I kind of sat in our patrol base, kind of giving this set of orders, literally eyeballing each of my soldiers, I could see in some of their eyes a mix of excitement, anticipation, and fear. And I mean, anyone who says that soldiers don't feel fear is either sort of a liar, clinically insane, probably both.
Right.
And it was almost a out-of-body experience where I suddenly was almost above myself and saw and heard a completely different set of words coming out of my mouth to those that I'd planned to say and I'd rehearsed. So literally kind of the orders I were giving changed from like, and I'll be passenger in the lead vehicle. As soon as we smash through the steel gates of the target house, I'll be the first man out with a sledgehammer sprinting for the front door. As soon as I smash down that front door, one section, you are to be right behind me. I'll step to the right. You are to charge in and secure the ground floor. And so the orders went on. But I guess back to your question that sort of led to that story. It's knowing as a leader when to lead from the front and when to lead from behind. Like a lot of the time, a leader's job isn't to be the one kind of out front, hey, look at me, follow me. Almost, I forget who said it, but sort of when things are going well, the leader's job is behind, kind of pushing your team and your people forward, especially when there's success to be celebrated.
Right.
But when things are going bad or when they're difficult or when something hasn't gone well and someone needs to stand up and sort of say, okay, we screwed up, then I think those are the times when as a leader, we step forward and take the foreground. Arguably, it wasn't my job to be literally the front guy in the most dangerous position, sledgehammering down the door. But there are times when you look around and think, that's what my soldiers needed in that moment to have the confidence in the operation that we had a good plan, it was going to be executed, and that they needed to follow somebody in that instant.
How did you know that you needed to step up and be the lead in that operations? And how did you manage your own psychology in order to be able to do that successfully? Because as you just said, it's the most dangerous spot. You are charging forwards. You are putting yourself into the most dangerous position. And not that you want to, you know, put someone else into that position ever. But I could see that would be a potential conflict internally in your brain. And you said it was sort of out of body, where you heard other words coming out of your mouth. And, you know, there's sort of that disconnection. I would just love for you to elaborate a little bit more, just because we cannot, like I cannot pretend to understand what you were going through. And I'm sure most of my listeners, although there are definitely some people from the military who I know listen to the show, they can probably identify with it, but the rest of us just don't understand that state. So you are recognizing that there is a problem. How do you do so? And then you need to step up and do something that is incredibly challenging, fear-based, danger-based, and you need to manage yourself to be able to get through that situation. Looking back now, do you see anything that you did that worked? I'd love you to deconstruct that a little bit more, because I think there's so much there for us to potentially learn from.
Yeah, so as you first asked me that question, my gut reaction was, well, I just looked at my soldiers and I just knew I had to to step up and do something different. But then it was great. You filled for me by expanding on your question, gave me thinking time. Actually, what enabled me to know, and I've not thought about this until you asked the question just now, came back to some advice or a constant learning I had leading up to that point. So like from 13 years old, when I decided to join the army, I'd spent years like talking to people who was in the army, reading books about it, studying it. How do you get people to follow you? And one of the key themes that came through that was drummed into us when I was at Sandhurst was know your men. Again and again, it was know your people. When you arrive as a young troop commander in the army, interview all of your soldiers, get to know them, understand what makes them tick, what soccer team they support, about their girlfriends, kids, families, where they grew up. We had what was called, we called it a troop Bible, which was like all the information about your soldiers. But I guess the lesson there is that if we're ultimately going to ask somebody to put their life on the line, not for us, because kind of I'm a representative of the army, but if as a leader, we're going to ask people to put their lives on the line, I think they will only do that if they know you see them as a human being, you know them, you care about them, they get a sense even, it's not really a word that we use when I was in the army, but it was there, even though it's untalked about, if they know that we love them.
Yeah.
That's what drives medals for bravery in the armed forces. It's not wanting to win a medal. It's not kind of doing as somebody above you in the rank structure tells you to, or because someone's shouting at you. It's because you don't want to let your brothers down, which is this kind of love family analogy. So back to your question, the only reason I just knew I needed to lead from the front is because I knew them well enough to recognize the look on their faces and the fact that their body language changed. That was how I knew, I guess.
And then you were able to take that. So you recognized that you needed to do something different. You needed to lead from the front. And then you throw yourself into harm's way and you have to manage yourself through that scenario. So I'm also curious, like how your mindset in that moment, is it just purely, I would guess that it is, you're launching just into pure execution in that moment. You're just doing, which is interesting. It's still that back to that dichotomy of lead versus do. And so once that switch flipped, you then begin to act. Would love to know sort of, how you did that. Like, how do you do that? It's beyond my capability of understanding. I've done some crazy stuff in my life, but like, that's so far beyond anything I can even begin to comprehend. Like, how do you do that? It just boggles my mind.
You've kind of touched on the answer. And it is that at that point, there's two things. I mean, the one is at that point, you are very much into pure execution.
Right.
So all of your planning for that operation, working out all of the what if scenarios and how we would counter them. Up by the point I'm standing in front of my soldiers and giving those orders, all that planning is done. And we know we've got a really robust plan to go and execute. So you switch from planning into execution and you know this is what we've got to do. Even literally, like from the moment the orders finish, we're then into literally rehearsing the operations, rehearsing getting in the trucks, the order we're getting out of the trucks, rehearsing like roughly where people are going to stand around an imaginary target house. So it's just a sequence of executionable actions and events that you're practicing. I think the interesting thing there is because I spend so much time sort of analyzing what can you transfer from the military into the civilian world? What works, what doesn't, and why don't some things work? I mean, one of the differences, I think, in the business world, and I see this a lot with clients of businesses I work with, we have the balance the other way around. So we had it in the military, that so often in business, we just dive straight into execution and doing.
Right.
Without anywhere near enough like planning time.
Couldn't agree more.
And then we wonder why events don't unfold as we expect, because we just launched into stuff. So planning and preparation gives us the confidence to execute on a solid plan, I think.
All right. And what do you do afterwards? So the operation is over, you're all back at the base. How do you deconstruct and learn and grow from those moments? I'm curious about what the deconstruction process is, or how you talk to each other afterwards. I assume that things go well, things don't go well. How do you manage that in a constructive way?
Again, it's a timely question, because that's something I've literally just been the last few months doing a lot of work on deconstructing and helping kind of corporate clients with.
Yeah.
But it's the classic, you've probably even had kind of guests on the show talk about it, but literally as soon as the operation is finished, first thing that happens is sort of circle up after action review, like who saw what happened, what worked, how did the execution of the operation go compared to what we planned. Sometimes they can be like quite punchy, can be a little bit kind of brutal, especially if things didn't go well.
Yeah.
Again, it's the discipline to do that straight away, no matter what, no matter how tired, exhausted you are. It's a process. Like, it's actually, it's not discipline. It's a process. We just know as soon as we're back in the gates, that's the next thing we do. Then once that's done, no matter what time it is, me as the leader, troop commander, write up my report to capture those, that gets fed into the system for future operations. But it's the discipline and process of no matter what happens, this is what we do, because we know it works.
Yeah, very cool. Not to so sensitive to like not driving you back into thinking about your military experiences for this entire interview, but how did you make the transition from military to civilian? When did you know it was time, and what did that transition in your life look like?
So I left the army back in 2006 as a sort of senior captain, having done 5 years post sort of training as an officer and two tours of Iraq. And my sort of, it's not really a goal, but my mindset was always I'll stay in the forces for as long as I kept enjoying it. There was probably three things that came together to help me make the decision to lead. One was halfway through my second Iraq tour, before I knew I was going, my fiance at the time and I had planned to get married. So the wedding was planned. I got a new poster and like, hey Joe, got some bad news. I'm off back to Iraq. I'll be there when we're getting married. So I basically went to Iraq, did 5 months, come home for 10 days, kind of got married. My wife moved from a flat in London with her sister to an army house in deepest, darkest Oxfordshire. And that was the start of the process where I didn't want to be doing overseas operational tours kind of as a married man. So that was one trigger.
I could see that might be a trick. That might be a moment that
would
spark some discussion and thinking. So
yeah,
I get it. It
led to a very traditional marriage in that we'd never lived together before we got married. So
right.
So in that respect, it was quite cool. So that was one. Second, this is probably the main reason, which circles back to one of your first questions, actually. During my second operational tour of Iraq, there was one particular captain in our regiment who was doing the senior captain's job, which is planning all of the major operations. It wasn't just kind of my view, others had this view, but the person doing that job wasn't competent. They were probably incompetent in that role, in my view. But they ended up in that job because up until major in the British Army, to a degree, you'll get certain jobs based on sort of time served. Beyond senior captain, it very much switches to performance based, and the very best people get the most challenging demanding jobs. But this particular officer, in my view, was incompetent to the point at which I believe they were planning operations that were putting soldiers' lives at risk.
Yeah.
And that, from a values perspective, really started to sit uncomfortably with me. And I ultimately couldn't reconcile that. It didn't fit with my values. So that, coupled with kind of family circumstances, and my sort of next jobs in the military would have been sort of headquarter planning jobs, probably for 3 to 4 years before I would be back kind of working with leading soldiers, which was what I loved. So sort of three factors really all came together, where it got to the point where, like, I just kind of sensed and felt that kind of I'd done what I wanted to achieve, and it was time to move on.
Okay. And then you moved into the corporate world, and now you've landed in a place where you're doing leadership guidance, transformational leadership work. And I'm really interested about, you know, what transferred over, what didn't transfer over, and, you know, what do you believe is critical for leadership in today's environment, which is obviously pretty challenging around the world?
Yeah. I think the service element that we spoke about is fundamental.
Yeah.
Sort of, I guess really what drives my work now is some of my core belief. It's really my purpose, or my why, I guess, in that I fundamentally believe that, be it in military, in business, in the sporting world, in the charitable sector, a leader's job fundamentally is about delivering the number, the target, the output, the hard business sporting measure. And it's about looking at after the people that we've got the privilege and responsibility to lead. Because for me, well, it's not for me, it's a true fact. Every single person that we lead is the most important person in someone else's life.
Right.
So how we act and behave as leaders, it doesn't just affect somebody between 9 and 5 whilst they're at work within the confines of the workspace. How we act and behave has an impact on how those people are when they go home with their loved ones. And then that has an impact on their loved ones. And as leaders, we have no right whatsoever to, on a regular basis, send someone home like stressed out, feeling undervalued, feeling sort of almost abused and taken advantage of in the workplace. Like, yes, those feelings crop up. Like, business gets stressful at times. We have to ask people to go above and beyond, and bad stuff happens at work. But as leaders, we've got no right to send people home continually in a negative state. So that's kind of what sits at the very core of leadership for me, which I think in the modern world, when we're bombarded with so much information, so many communication channels, we're all working longer, harder, faster. I just think that becomes even more important in the modern workplace.
So that's so fascinating, because I haven't thought, as you're speaking, I'm remembering, you know, a moment previously in my career where I had a quote unquote boss who was definitely having a negative impact on, you know, everybody. And even though it was just at work, the impact in all of our lives outside of work was, you know, people weren't sleeping and people were super stressed. Like, it's incredible the impact that you can have on the people around you. And I hadn't, you know, until you sort of brought it up, really purposely sort of considered the impact is really on every aspect of those people's lives, which therefore makes your responsibilities/abilities as a leader that much more critically important.
Yeah, totally, absolutely. And that's why I think, not just as leaders, I think as anybody in the workplace, like, being really clear on your personal values, what you stand for, what you would take a stand on, and the stuff that's really important to you becomes like so fundamental to success as a leader, and success and broader success in work and more broadly in life and happiness. So my second job after leaving the army was working at the UK's biggest retailer, Tesco. I was only there for about 18 months for a number of reasons. But back then I still understood the importance of values. If you'd asked me what my personal values are, I probably would have straight away given you a couple. But I've done a lot of work on it since and continue to do so. And it's a big part of the work I do with senior leaders. But when I finally went home and said to my wife, I've had enough, I'm handing my notice in, I'm leaving Tesco, she kind of sighed and said, at last. She said, at last, have you not realized how unhappy and miserable you've been?
Really?
And I didn't really realize. I didn't notice it because I was in the midst of it, going to work each day, trying to deliver. But fundamentally, my values and view of leadership at that point of Tesco's kind of evolution were completely at odds. So I was going to work fundamentally trying to be somebody different to who I was in order to succeed and grow as a leader in that organization. And I didn't spot it at the time. If I worked there now, I probably wouldn't even have taken the job, or I'd have got 3-4 months in and I'd realized like this doesn't work. I mean, that's the power of really, like a lot of people talk about kind of values are important in terms of leadership, know your values. But I don't think people often realize how important it is. And I think people not that many people do the deep internal work to really understand what's important to you. Because it's hard, right? It's hard. Like we share a lot of the same values on this. So you know where I'm coming from, Greg. But that working out, what do I really stand for? It's not the sort of thinking that we like spend time on in day-to-day work. It's all about the task, the next project, the deliverables. So we think this is hard, therefore I'll stop and move on to something a little bit easier.
And we've been going through this journey together for a few years now. So you're very right. Like, you know, what do I believe in? What do I stand for? What are my personal values? What are my personal values at work? What type of work do I want to be doing? How do I want to, you know, who am I in my role as in whatever work that I do? Those are all pretty powerful, pretty important, very critical questions that you're right. We're often far too busy to spend time trying to figure out the answer to those questions. Those aren't typical meeting questions. Or if you throw something like that out, you're going to have crickets in a room very, very, very quickly. And they are fundamentally critical. I don't know if you ever really have an answer to them. I think they're constantly evolving. But how did you arrive at your understanding of the fact that you were, maybe not how, because you already explained how you arrived at understanding that there was a misalignment there. But once you realized that there was a misalignment there, how did you craft your values so that the next thing that you did was more in alignment with what you wanted to be doing, and ultimately it led to where you are today, where you are actually doing largely mission-driven work most of the time?
Yeah. I mean, there's two answers to that question. I think one is, so I have no scientific, psychological basis for what I'm about to say. It's my insight, my anecdotal experience. But I believe as individuals, we have a primary and a secondary set of core values. Now, where that came from was when I was writing my book, I'd finished the manuscript, sent it to the publishers, and they come back with a load of questions. They said, I see in this chapter, Ben, you wrote about how our values change over time. And they went, do values change over time? And yeah, I can see your face. So your face was like my face and thought process. I'm like, oh man, do values change? Uh-oh, I've finished the manuscript. Don't make me question it and change it. So I kind of went off and I kind of did some more research. I kind of did some more reflection. And where I got to is I've no idea where this comes from, but if you ask most people about personal values, even organizational values, like this magic number seems to have cropped up where it's like 5 or 6. We all, for some reason, seem to think we have to have 5 or 6 values. I've no idea where that comes from. I've never found any research that says it's this number. So I think we probably have a list of 8, 9, 10 values that are important to us. And depending on what's going on in life at any one time, the relative importance of those changes. I suspect there's maybe 5 or 6 that are really important to you at any one time. They're your primary. And then there are some others that are important but aren't primary right now. So the example I use to describe this is I've got an eight-year-old daughter. If you'd asked me 10 years ago what my core values are, like, family wouldn't have been in there.
Right.
Like, family has always been important to me. I'm kind of super close to my mum and my dad. I've got an older sister, but family wouldn't have been in my core values. Like, it's now absolutely kind of right up there, kind of number 1 or 2. It's just moved from that primary to secondary, depending on what's going on in life. So that's sort of the piece around arriving at them. But it's a lot of thinking, is it that, kind of they change and evolve. You start to unpick what the words actually mean. Like, what does integrity really mean to me? It's a long process. And then the reason I say I probably wouldn't end up working somewhere like Tesco now is one of my protocols or routines is that I set a quarterly review for myself, which is basically half a day every quarter where I'd sit. It's not the business, nothing to do with my business. It's all, I'm reviewing myself. So
right.
How am I doing at living my purpose? And then the next thing I do is I list out my 5 values and I score myself out of 5 on every single one. And then write about it, deconstruct it. Where have I done well? Where haven't I been true to this value? What do I need to do in the next 90 days to strive to live up to this value even more? And they're at the front of my journal, so they're front and center. And every week, kind of, I'm seeing them. They're in my face, so I can't hide from them.
Yeah.
Which I think is important, even though they're our core values. And you could argue, well, if they're your core values, why do you need to be reminded of them? Like, we're human. I think we do need to.
100%, because there's busy work and then there's important work. And the busy work takes you away from the important work. So you do have to remind yourself of, you know, what is your big 5 goals for the year? What are your 5 values that you want to check in on? I actually text message a mutual friend of ours, Stu Saunders, every Monday morning with our 5 goals for the week. Like, you need to be held accountable. I totally get it. So it's interesting that you do the quarterly review. I like that idea.
Yeah, it's probably been a practice about 3 years now.
Okay.
It's always extreme to say it's been a game changer like that. That
yeah.
phrase gets bandied around a lot, but as part of a personal development, personal planning cycle, it's been huge.
Yeah, very cool. Tell me about your book.
So it's a couple of years old now, really, but I set out to write a very different type of leadership book, one that would catch people's attention. If you just scan through the pages, just some of the illustrations in there certainly catch people's attention. So it's part, I guess it's part biography, part business book, part leadership manual. So first part sort of tracks my sort of military experience, kind of lessons learned in terms of leadership, building teams throughout my military career. Then we've got a quite cool James Bond-esque sort of parable section, which is really about my corporate career when I was kind of employed in the corporate world. And then the kind of final third of the book starts to kind of pull out kind of all of those sort of key leadership lessons. So that's the book.
Yeah, right on. And the title, just for everyone who might want to check it out?
Mission Leadership, Lifting the Mask.
Amazing. All right. A few rapid fire questions for you. Any specific routines, tactics, meals, or other strategies that you use before big performance events that you might want to share with people? So let's say it's a key meeting, key presentation. Is there anything that you do to help get ready for those sorts of events?
Sleep.
Like, oh, wow.
I'm with you. I like I've various kind of routines. The one thing that I never compromise on is sleep. Like exercise is really important to me. If it's a choice between getting enough sleep and getting the exercise in, sleep trumps everything for me.
Interesting. That's very cool. Who are you following right now? Like, who has your attention? What are you learning about? What are you studying? Where is your, who's got your attention at the moment?
I'm very much one of these where I can read a book and it takes me down a kind of down the rabbit warren of something else. So I'm actually reading the Checklist Manifesto now.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is by Atul Garwind, I think. I'll check it out and send you the detail. Like, I didn't know you could write an entire book about checklists, but
apparently you can,
which came from reading a book about the latest book by the former England rugby coach Clive Woodward. He mentioned the checklist book, so that's just taking me down this route. But for me, it's just all, at the minute, it's just all learning about high performance teams, characteristics of great teams. What are some of the not so common habits that are common amongst all of the world's best teams? Just really going deep into high performance teams.
Interesting. So about checklists, I remember one of the speeches I did a few years ago, which you may have seen actually, I talked about Felix Baumgartner and the Red Bull Stratus mission when he jumped out of the balloon from, I think, 162,000 feet. But in the shot, the video, right before he steps out, as the door opens, if you look on the inside of the capsule, there's literally checklists everywhere. So he's not making any decisions. He's just simply following a process. And the last two Ironmans that I've done, one was successful, one was not, which we're learning from, I discovered that you cannot make decisions in the moment. Everything needs to be pre-planned out in advance, from what you eat, what clothes are you wearing, what socks do you wear. Because if there's any decision-making when you're under stress, it tends not to be done and you tend to make mistakes. So I'm a big fan of checklists. Even yesterday, I went to an event with the company, and you know, I brought all of my connectors for connecting my computer to the AV system, but I didn't bring the different set of connectors if someone else doesn't have USB-C. I normally bring them. I didn't bring them. It was on my checklist. I don't know why I didn't bring them. So we were scrambling. It was a mistake because I didn't follow my checklist. Like, this is actually really interesting. It's an interesting hole you're going down. It's one that's, I think, really relevant for us because I think it helps you to perform when you're under pressure.
Yeah, totally. So there's a few things I'm playing around with. So just this year in the January sales, I went out and bought 5 shirts, all exactly the same.
Yep.
Because I just don't want to get up in the morning and decide what shirt to wear, because
love it.
Work and my business is busy at the minute, so the more decisions I can take out of the equation, the better. Then to your checklist point, I was doing running a session as part of a pitch about four weeks ago for a piece of work that kind of really wanted to win, because the client I really wanted to work with, and I knew that going into the client's offices, I'd be up against it time wise, getting everything set up how I wanted it set up. And like, I've set training rooms up and rooms when I'm facilitating working with exec teams for like 7 years now. Like, I know what I'm doing, but I wrote myself a specific checklist for that, even down to the order that I would do things, like plug in, connect a laptop, set up music, materials on chairs, because I just wanted to know, no matter how late I was, here was my process, here was the priority order. So if I didn't get all the way through it because time was short, I'd done the main stuff, just because I knew otherwise I'd be going in there on the back foot mentally, like stressed and worrying. So
yeah,
like, checklists, I love them.
They're very cool. What's the one thing that you would recommend people listening right now do or try that might be new for them? Something you'd like everyone to give a good, like, just, you know, give this a shot and see how it works.
Wow, that's a great question.
And I did not give these to you in advance, so you're like, it's not like you had a chance to prepare. So I'm just like, see what pops into your head.
Yeah, so I know so many people you've had on the podcast talk about this. Like, in Tim Ferriss's books, it's really clearly a theme. Again, I've probably been doing this for 5 years. Like, carving out, I think, 10 minutes That's all it needs to be. 15 is great. At the start of your day, before you pick up your phone, before you look at your emails, before someone grabs your attention, just planning out your day, some form of journaling and planning process, so you can sort of be proactive instead of reacting to the world around you. I think that probably is the one thing when I work with senior leaders and leadership teams, there's one thing I wish they would try and install as a habit. It would be that. And it's often the one that they resist the most, because it's like, ah, great, Ben, it's okay for you being self-employed. I've seen your social pictures of you sitting having your flat white coffee whilst you're doing your morning planning and journaling, but that's not my world. I can't possibly do it. There's so much resistance to it, because people just want to get on with the doing and the execution. And then I love it when a year down the line, people come back to me and go, ah, Ben, I've been trying that journaling thing for the last like 3 months. It's changed my world.
Again,
like the modern world, I think it's just so important.
Amazing. Ben, I know that we're running up against time here and you're a busy guy, so I want to respect that. I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to come on the show and share your wisdom. We could have obviously talked about each one of those topics for like hours, as we did walking around London a few weeks ago. And I'm just grateful to have you around on the show and count you as a friend. So thanks for coming on, buddy. I really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. Big fan of the show. I was listening to it in the car coming back from a meeting today. So it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Right on.
So there you have it, folks. My interview on the Professor Greg Wells podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got loads of value. And as always, if you did, please share away on social media. And please do head to iTunes and subscribe so that we can keep bringing you more and more episodes with fantastic leaders and subject matter experts like Greg himself. That's it for this episode. See you again soon and lead on.